10 others. The Oak Fire is the largest of California's fire season so far, but it pales in comparison to last year's Dixie Fire, which burned through almost 1 million acres. A UN report published in February says the number of extreme wildfires globally will increase by 30% by the year 2050. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 87 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 82 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico. Coming up, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
That was, of course, Anton Kara's theme song for me now, from The Third Man for the last 6-7 years, I believe. I just saw The Third Man again a few days ago. I've seen it like 100 times. By the way, I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI.org. And, of course, support the station by going to give2wbai.org, the number 2 right in between give. WBAI. All right. Listen, I always have a little anxiety when I have Stephen Kinzer on the show. I don't know what it is. There are certain people that Cornel West, John Pilger, because I know I've got to do my research. And if I don't do enough research, I get anxiety. Stephen Kinzer will be here in just 1 minute. I must say that I was just told that we do have the Assange reader as a premium for those who make a donation to the station of $75, which you can do. And that's the book by the torture dude from the UN, special rapporteur on torture, Niels Melzer. It's called The Trial of Julian Assange. And then the book that's edited by Margaret Kunstler and Tariq Ali called In Defense of Julian Assange. So make that pledge and get those books, because Julian is in very bad shape. I don't know if you've seen the reports. Doctor said in the prison of Belmarsh, very grim outlook in the next few months. All right. So Stephen Kinzer, by the way, I'm going to say this now so I don't have to say it to him when he's on the line. is an award-winning foreign correspondent. He served in Latin America as a correspondent for the Boston Globe and then as a bureau chief for the New York Times in Nicaragua, where I met him, Germany, and Turkey. And he is the author of many books, but the ones we're going to, bring up today are these four, and because they revolve around the CIA. It's The Brothers. It's about Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles. The Poisoner in Chief. We had him on last year talking about Sidney Gottlieb overthrow, which from 48 in that book, 48 until like 2003, deals with the CIA. All the Shah's Men and Bitter Fruit, which I got a copy from him. Mr. Kinzer back in 1986 in Managua. So why don't we just play this? Also, he penned this in 2000 at the 6-year anniversary of the death of Jelly Roll Morton in the New York Times. The man who made jazz hot 60 years after his death, Jelly Roll Morton, gets respect. All right, we're going to show him some respect right now. This is Levee Man Blues by Jelly Roll Morton, and we'll be right back with Stephen Kinzer.
I'm a levee man. I'm a levee man. said, Captain, Captain, let me make this trip. I said, Captain, Captain, let me make this trip.
All right. The late, great Jelly Roll Morton. I'm Randy Credico, Randy Credico, here on Live on the Fly at WBAI. And joining us from the great state of Boston, I mean Massachusetts, from Boston, is Stephen Kinzer. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Always good to be with you, Randy.
Tell me about Levee Mann Blues before we get into the heavy stuff.
Just listening to that takes me all the way back to the days when I was the New York Times national culture correspondent. I had a great assignment. I was finishing up my years in Turkey, and the New York Times had a job called European culture correspondent, where you live in Paris and you fly around Europe and go to museums and go to the opera and go to the theater. So I called up an editor and said, the guy that has that job seems to have been there for a long time. Why don't you give me that job? And the editor said, well, I'm not going to give you that job, but I have an alternative. We're going to have a job called national culture correspondent. That would be you live in Chicago and you travel around America going to the opera and going to the theater and going to the museum. I said, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah, what a terrible job that would be.
Really, really, really great. And one of the things I was able to do was pursue some of my own interests. And Jelly Roll Morton and the history of jazz certainly fits in that category. So when I was in New Orleans, I did some digging about Jelly Roll Morton. I started immersing myself in his recordings. And just so you know, I don't always write about how the U.S. overthrows foreign governments. I did have a chance to write a long piece about Jelly Roll Morton and the origins of jazz. And in some ways, that was even more satisfying.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. It's November 28, 2000, you penned this in the New York Times. And the man who made jazz hot, he really did make jazz hot. Am I right?
You certainly hear it in that piece you played. It's restrained. It's not in your face. Don't forget, jazz went through a whole series of phases after that. You had the old, what we now call Dixieland jazz. Then it was came through the swing era. You get to bebop. This was something like the greatest split since Constantinople between the old jazz and the new jazz. But all of this had its beginning back in the bordellos of New Orleans and people like Jelly Roll Morton. So it was a nice cap for me to a career that exposed me to a lot of funerals, a lot of blood, a lot of crying mothers. It was nice to be able to see that humanity has a more positive side.
Yeah, well, I certainly take that gig. We're talking with Stephen Kinzer, and now we can get to the blood and the crying mothers and all of that, I suppose. You know, I've been flashing through your Twitter account, and there was something I wanted to get right into the CIA. And I want to get into CIA and as it relates to Assange. But before I do that, I saw something that you put down the other a retweet or something. You had a comment, and it was this woman. What's her name? Laura Richardson, who's the head of Southcom. The reason why I bring this up, because I met you in Nicaragua. You were a foreign correspondent for Latin America. You were with the New York Times for Central America. And so I just kind of had a flashback when I saw this and listened to it. So my friend Kelly Lane, who works on my Assange Countdown to Freedom show on my website, put this, a few clips together. So let's play the one that says MIC.
This region is so rich in resources. It's off the charts rich. And they have a lot to be proud of. And our competitors and adversaries also know how rich in the resources that this region is. 60% of the world's lithium is in the region. You have heavy crude. You have light sweet crude. You have rare earth elements. You have the Amazon, which is called the lungs of the world. You have the 31% of the world's fresh water here in this region. And there are adversaries that are taking advantage of this region every single day, right in our neighborhood. And I just look at what happens in this region in terms of security, impacts our security, our national security, in the homeland and in the United States.
Steve, would you unpack what she just said there?
So that one is really horrifying. If you didn't already have a sense of how we look at Latin America, that clip would be very shocking. So essentially what she's saying, she is now the general who is the chief American military officer overseeing all U.S. military operations in Latin America. And so how does she see Latin America and America and the role of the United States there? Is it to promote and solidify democracy? Is it to address the inequalities of society there? Is it to build constructive trade relations? No. What she's thinking about is looting the resources of that continent. This is what she's talking about. And you can see how Latin Americans would feel hearing this. So this is what America thinks of us. We're the place that has 60% of the world's lithium. No, that's not what Latin America is. Latin America is something far deeper and far richer than that. So that clip just showed how little America has progressed, really, from the days when United Fruit went down to Central America and turned those countries into vassal states in order to enrich American investors. It's such a bad look. You know, it's, of course, this is the way we act in the world, but we're not supposed to say it. This was a case where kind of your slip is showing. They let it out a little too obvious. What are we interested in Latin America? It's all the oil and all the crude and all the lithium and all the minerals. That's it. And when you think of that as being the mission of the United States military in Latin America, that also sheds a lot of light on what the U.S. military is all about and what it sees its role as being in the world.
Well, she says our enemies are exploiting it. What does she mean by that? Enemies are exploiting what? You know, China's building did a railroad in Argentina when I was there, and because the rail system was horrible, and moving soybeans and all of that from down south up to north. Transporting it, and they built that, and I guess they get something out of it. But why doesn't the U.S. do something like that?
In Central America, where I worked for many years, there is one stadium that is of world-class Olympic size with all the right facilities. It's in Costa Rica. That stadium was built by the Chinese. Now, the Chinese did not extract any pledges from Costa Rica, nor demand anything political, but you have to assume that people in Costa Rica and maybe the rest of Central America raise their eyebrows and think, wow, look what China did. They built us the only stadium we have in a world class, nobody else would do this. Why isn't the United States thinking of projects like that? So I think when she says our adversaries are working, it's true that China is now the biggest trading partner of Latin America, just like China is the largest trading partner of Africa.
Right.
But that's only because of U.S. ignoring these countries for so long. China is reaping the benefit of two decades of constant engagement with countries that the United States essentially ignores. Now we wake up and see the result of our policies, and we're seeing it as a kind of a hostile takeover. But these countries in Latin America have their own free will. They're pursuing their own national interests, and their long-term interest is to deal with China, because China is the principal buyer of their goods and doesn't make political demands on them the way the United States has done for more than a century.
Yeah, a century of U.S. policy in mostly Latin America in the book Overthrow, which came out in 2006. This goes way back. Hawaii first, I suppose. That was the first U.S. Imperialistic move. But the Spanish Civil War war in Cuba, which we got in there. And in that book, You go from there to Nicaragua. How many countries did the U.S. get involved in and didn't build anything but just overthrew the governments all the way up until, I guess, Allende?
The Caribbean Basin, that is the Caribbean islands, Cuba, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, plus Central America and Mexico, have been an intense focus of American intervention for more than 100 years. Don't forget it was Woodrow Wilson who ordered the punitive expedition when General Pershing charged into Mexico to capture Pancho Villa, something he was never able to do. Mexicans are acutely aware of the fact that more than a third of their country was sliced away by the United States. The huge horror that has descended on Guatemala over the last 70 years is principally the result of United States foreign policy.
Right.
Honduras finally elected or was allowed to elect a leader who represents popular will, but for the last 15 years or so, Honduras was governed by a group of narcotic-dealing thugs who were totally supported by the United States because they allowed American corporations to come in and loot Honduras. Nicaragua has probably been the object of more United States intervention over a longer period of time than any country in the world. We first overthrew a government of Nicaragua in 1909. Then we sent Marines there in the 1920s and 30s to fight the Sandino uprising. Later, we supported the Somoza dictatorship. And when the Sandinistas finally overthrew Somoza, we sponsored a war to try to overthrow the Sandinistas. So the countries of Central America have a long and bitter experience with the United States. And it must seem a little eye-rolling to them to see the United States in the person of this general and others, warning that there's some other enemies out there who want to exploit Latin America for their own benefit. Yeah, they've had some experience with that.
Right. So I guess President Obrador, AMLO, is well aware of this history, and I found it really exhilarating when he came to the White House and pretty much dressed down Biden and then gave him a letter if you're going to extradite Assange, why don't you just send the Statue of Liberty to Mexico City, all right? Because it ain't worth anything in that New York Harbor. What did you make of first of all? What did you make of AMLO not showing up at that OAS confab in Southern California?
I thought it was interesting, and I understood why he did it, but I didn't think he really played that as well as he could. Here's what I would have done. As you just said, AMLO, the Mexican president, is a great supporter of Julian Assange. Now, the United States was desperate to get AMLO to come to that confab, as you call it, the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles. He wouldn't go because other countries that we don't like were not being invited. So here's what I would have advised him. You know, we were desperate to get him to go. Biden appointed Chris Dodd, the former senator, to go all over Latin America and try to pressure every president to show up. So what I think AMLO should have done is told Chris Dodd and through him Biden, I got a deal for you. I'm going to show up at your summit, and I'll do everything you want me to do there. And in exchange, I want you to send me Assange. So that would have been my recommendation. I would have loved to see how that turned out.
Yeah, you know what? And I really on this show have not asked about Assange, but that was a bold move by him. But it would have been bolder if he had made that the quid pro quo and put Biden in a bad situation, you know. But Biden shows up to see MBS in Saudi Arabia, and he's shaking his hand, giving him the bump. And so from AMLO to MBS, I don't want to like get into that too much. But what about that relationship with Saudi Arabia?
I don't mind presidents of the United States dealing with dictators. Sometimes it's in the national interest.
Right.
But first of all, I don't think you should praise them and sort of get down on your knees and genuflect, which is more or less what Biden did. He came with a tin cup asking for some help. I don't think that's the right approach. Dealing with dictators is valuable when it's in the national interest. But in this case, there was no interest. We're not getting anything from Saudi Arabia. I'm really impressed to see now that the United States is in a position where we're desperate for additional oil supplies. That's why Biden, among other reasons, went to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to pump more and ship more. So he's willing to do that, but he's not willing to turn to the two countries that have huge amounts of oil available, and that is Venezuela and Iran. He won't deal with Venezuela, which has even larger oil reserves than Saudi Arabia, if you can believe that, because Venezuela is ruled by a dictator. So what does he do instead? He goes to Saudi Arabia, which is an absolute dictatorship where the prince orders people beheaded in public or dismembered at will, and where there's not the hint of democracy. And he does this, Biden does this, in order not to have to deal with a dictator like Maduro in Venezuela. So it shows you how deep are these prejudices. Better to deal with somebody like the Saudi prince than to loosen your policies in the Western Hemisphere and get your oil from Venezuela.
Right. Well, I mean, the policy in Venezuela, it's not even given an olive branch. It's like these sanctions are just killing the country. I guess they just want to squeeze them until they fall and then grab the oil. Is that what, going back to Laura Richardson was hinting at in her little one-minute slip?
Maybe so, but I would argue this. Political scientists have studied in detail all the times when the United States has sought to shape and overthrow countries in order to secure their resources, pacify them, and take what they want. In fact, it almost never works. Our interventions produce more civil wars, more violence, more upheaval, and the benefits for the United States economically are short-lived and often counterbalanced by a tremendous amount of political resentment that festers and leads to future conflicts. You know, one thing I've learned from studying histories of American intervention is that we forget them. The Americans forget that we did them. Nobody knows that we fought a war in the Philippines and killed 200,000 people, or that we overthrew the democracy of Guatemala and Iran in the early 1950s, and on and on. But the people in those countries do not forget. The memories of those interventions fester and burn in their hearts and minds and souls. And that resentment winds up shaping generations of attitudes toward the United States. That's the reason why we need such a strong military, because we've done so much to alienate these populations that we often need military intervention to suppress their expression.
Two of the books, you know, you're talking about Central America, Bitter Fruit, which was, came out. This is actually the 40-year anniversary of Bitter Fruit. The other book is All the Shah's Men. And both of them have the fingerprints of Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles. Looking back at that book, have you been to Guatemala in the last 20 years to see?
Yes, I have, sure.
And what was your feeling down there? Was there still bitterness to the U.S.? Had people forgotten, or is it still in their conscience?
I think there's a rebirth of interest in what happened in Guatemala in the 1950s. Don't forget that during all the years of dictatorship in Guatemala, it wasn't possible to discuss the presidency of Jacobo Arbenz, the president that we overthrew. Even mentioning his name was taboo. So it's only now that people are beginning to resurrect the interest in Arbenz and what happened in the 50s. But I can tell you that from the American point of view, our overthrow of the democratic government of Guatemala and its replacement by a dictatorship, and our overthrow of the democratic government of Iran and its replacement with a dictatorship happened within less than a year. This was the opening salvo of the Eisenhower-Dulles administration in 1953 and 1954. Both of those coups almost failed, but then they did succeed in the end. And that gave the CIA a sense of momentum. We had overthrown two governments that we didn't like, and we got to see how easy it was. Now, these were countries that were just not equipped to deal with the kinds of subversion that the United States was now able to unleash. So now, those early CIA coups in the early 1950s set a pattern. Later on, one of the CIA officers after the Bay of Pigs invasion said, if the Guatemala invasion and overthrow hadn't gone so well, we never would have done the Bay of Pigs. So it was those early invasions that gave the CIA this motivation to go out and do it again, and gave American presidents the sense that this was actually a peace project. I think that's what Eisenhower felt. By overthrowing governments clandestinely, we don't have to invade them, and lots of people don't have to die.
Right.
So we now see what Eisenhower couldn't foresee, is that these interventions seemed successful at the time. And actually, if history would just stop, we could congratulate ourselves. But history doesn't stop. It keeps unfolding. And with the passage of time, we see what enormous disasters these coups were and what forces they unleashed that are still tyrannizing those two particular countries, Iran and Guatemala, and many others around the world. So these interventions show you that when you interfere violently in the affairs of another country, you're doing something like, say, releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. You can let it go, but you have absolutely no idea of where it's going to bounce and how it's going to end up. So many of these interventions have wound up not only devastating the target country, but also undermining the security interests of the United States.
Well, yes, the CIA has really grown like the blob. It keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more secretive, and it's scary. I want to play this. You're talking about violent overthrows of, whether it be we planned the whatever happened in Chile and Guatemala and Iran. But we've been involved in other covert operations, messing with their elections. Now, here's James Woolsey. I saw this on your my friend Kelly, who works with me, she got this clip of former CIA director James Woolsey. And he said this, and I found it to be alarming.
Have we ever tried to meddle in other countries' elections?
Oh, probably. But it was for the good of the system in order to avoid the communists from taking over. For example, in Europe in 47, 48, 49, the Greeks and the Italians. We
don't do that CIA. Now, though. We don't mess around other people's elections. Yeah?
Only for a very good
Can
cause.
Can you do that to a Vine video on a former CIA director?
Only for a very good cause and the interest in democracy.
All right, thanks for being here. It's always great to see.
Well, that was quite an admission. Did you find that shocking, Steve?
I thought it was a moment of candor. He said that we interfere in other countries' elections now? And he said only for good reason. So I think any country that interferes could use that same excuse. It's definitely true that the U.S. is aggressively involved in trying to shape the domestic politics in many countries. This traditionally was a job of the CIA. You penetrate labor unions and student groups and newspapers. You try to so-called train people in techniques of information gathering and organizing. That was a CIA project for many years, but it isn't really anymore. The CIA has moved on, as you said, to so many other things. They now run entire wars, and they're now involved in 100 different so-called security operations. Now we have something called the National Endowment for Democracy, and its two subsidiaries, which are funded by the Democratic and Republican parties. So the Congress provides the money for these institutions, which go around the world and then try to recruit people in various countries to come to America for seminars or to join organizations that are friendly to the United States or to take political action in their country against their government. So American intervention in the political affairs of other countries has been a constant and is still a very important part of American foreign policy. Don't forget that people in those countries are increasingly aware of this. And that is what's creating a good deal of the backlash against the United States among the so-called neutralist states now emerging, the abstainers.
Yeah, I'm looking at the CIA has really accumulated just exponential power. How much power do they have over decisions that are made by Congress, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the President, you know, and the NSC? How much power do they have? Do they hold sway because they've become so big?
I have a little passage in my book about the Dulles brothers in which I talk about what happened when Alan Dulles would go up to Capitol Hill and testify on the CIA budget. The senators would say things like, now don't tell us anything we don't need to know. And then they would say, we don't, just tell us how much money you want, and we'll give it to you. I think there's always been a sense that CIA deserves carte blanche, and that's still very strong. I think there's an automatic assumption in the Washington establishment that whatever our security agencies do must be right. It's amazing how many elected politicians buy into this. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the CIA is promoting conflicts in the world that also greatly enrich many Americans, including American arms makers. Those are the companies that have huge impact in Washington. I don't think there's anybody on Capitol Hill who has a full idea of what the CIA is and what the CIA is doing now. It would be almost a monumental task even to put that list together. And when you go beyond the CIA and think of the entire so-called intelligence community and all those contractors that are out in Virginia around Washington, D.C., I doubt that there's any individual anywhere in the CIA, in Congress, anywhere, who knows everything that all those people are doing and all those contractors are doing. So there really is a kind of a Moloch monster out there that is functioning on its own momentum. And there is no meaningful supervision. I attribute a lot of that, as I said, to the civilian politicians who should be exercising the oversight. They are so willing to give a free pass to intelligence agencies who have spooked us with their threat inflation into believing that we're on the edge of annihilation and we're all going to be dead if we don't listen to them. The willingness of politicians to fall for this reflects how easily swayed American people are. That's the line Americans want to hear. Oh, we're never going to give in. We're going to fight them. We're going to support our boys. And this plays very well in the United States. I do think that there's a changing opinion among the American public about U.S. interventionism and our role in the world. I think there many polls have shown this, that Americans are sick of this. They'd like to spend more of our resources at home and not get involved in every foreign conflict. However, this changing mindset has not affected Washington, D.C. In Washington, nothing has changed, even though it may be changing outside the Beltway.
Steve Kinzer, he's an expert on the CIA. I mean, just look at these great books, epic books, The Brothers, Poisoner in Chief. We talked about that for an hour last year. Overthrow, half of it is about CIA involvement around the world. All the Shah's Men. And then Bitter Fruit, and many other books, The First Flag and a whole bunch of others that you can get those. And I recommend that you read about the CIA through these books. Can you just give us an overview of this, the birth, the genesis of the CIA and how its mission has morphed into what it is today?
It's actually a very interesting story, which I do tell in my book, The Brothers, which is about the in part about the early days of the CIA. So during the Second World War, the United States had a foreign intelligence agency, a covert action agency. That was the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. Alan Dulles had been an OSS officer. In fact, he was the head of the OSS station in Switzerland during the Second World War. So after the Second World War, he was looking to move up, and he did get an assignment to become the OSS station chief in Berlin. He's moving into just-defeated Germany, and he's going to be setting up the big American intelligence network there. And suddenly, President Harry Truman made a shocking announcement. He's abolishing the OSS. He decided that America does not need an intelligence and covert action agency in peacetime, so gone. So there, Alan Dulles, instead of going to be the director of American covert action in Berlin, winds up back in New York with these other former OSS officers who now have to go back to their jobs as bank executives and international lawyers, doing jobs that are so mundane compared to what they had been doing in the Second World War. So they spent a lot of time together just reminiscing about the great old days and plotting about how they could get the United States back into the covert action business. Finally, as after the beginning of the Korean War, President Truman was prevailed upon to consider the establishment of a new American intelligence agency. Alan Dulles was the co-author of the National Security Act passed in 1947, in which the CIA was created. And in that bill, he did something that was very important and was even noted a bit at the time. It had always been a tradition in secret services, particularly in Britain, where the spy service was considered to be the world gold standard, that you keep an absolute division between, on the one hand, the analysts who figure out what's happening in other countries, and on the other hand, the covert operatives who go out and overthrow governments. You should never allow the same people or the same agency to do both jobs, because if you do, every analysis is going to come back saying, we need to overthrow this government. But Alan Dulles wrote the National Security Act in a way that put both of these functions together. So the people that were supposed to be observing and analyzing the world were also the people who were going to decide who to overthrow and then to go out and carry out the overthrows. So this is what led the CIA to become different from an intelligence gathering operation. It was actually an aggressive covert action agency. And when Eisenhower came in, he removed one of the major strictures that Truman had put on the CIA. Truman allowed the CIA to engage in covert action, but not to overthrow governments. Specifically rejected plans proposed by Alan Dulles to overthrow the governments of Iran and Guatemala. As soon as Eisenhower came in, that restriction was off, and the first projects were those two overthrows. But even during the 1950s, the CIA was a very quiet organization. Most Americans couldn't have even told you what those initials stood for. Over the years since then, as you point out, it has morphed into something completely different. The wars in Afghanistan and in Nicaragua were completely run by the CIA. This was something completely unexpected. The CIA was never supposed to be running war. But now it's taken that over. It's a war-fighting organization, as well as supposedly the organization that advises American government on how to control the world. So now the CIA itself is not as dominant in the intelligence community as it used to be, because we've got all these other agencies that were put together after 9/11. Nonetheless, the CIA has a certain in Washington, kind of as a miracle worker, the one that will make all our problems go away. And that's just what it did in a place like Iran and Guatemala. It made our problems go away for a few days. This is why I say it's great for countries to act in their own national interest. I'm all for this. But you should stop and think about what really is in your long-term national interest and not do things that make you feel good for a few days, but in the end wind up disastrous for your own security.
A few hundred thousand people lost their lives in Guatemala post the 54 Armas coup. Now the CIA, I think of Chuck Schumer told Trump that don't mess with them because they can find a way to screw you 6 days from Sunday. And I think it's my conclusion. Now, I've been working on this Assange project here. I've been done everything I possibly could do. I'm a big supporter. I think that something happens to him if he is extradited, that it will have a major effect on the First Amendment. Now, I think that the CIA is the one that's really the driving force. And I want to go back to this Mike Pompeo back in 2017. This is just after he becomes CIA chief and just after Vault 7 is released by Julian Assange. Now, take a listen to this. This is what he said.
It's time to call out WikiLeaks for what it really is, a non-state hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors like Russia. We know this because Assange and his ilk make common cause with dictators today. Yes, they try unsuccessfully to cloak themselves and their actions in the language of liberty and privacy, but in reality, they champion nothing but their own celebrity. Their currency is clickbait. Their moral compass, non-existent. Their mission, personal self-aggrandizement through destruction of Western values.
And right after that, an intensive spy operation was launched inside the Ecuadorian embassy. I was one of those that is on the videotape. Go to the videotape, and you will see. I'm just a comic talking about, I was friendly. We were friendly, but I wasn't talking about anything. I don't know anything about code and any of this, technology. I still have an AOL account. So... you take a look at that, his statement, is it your do you surmise that it's the CIA that is the driving force behind the persecution of Assange?
I'm not so sure that it's the key force. You know, I really think that there were a group of American politicians led by Hillary Clinton who were very embarrassed and humiliated by Julian Assange revealing what hypocrites they were and what lawbreakers they were. Hillary had to go on a worldwide tour. They called it the apology tour, where she had to go and make up to all those people that she was lied to when their lies were her lies were revealed by Julian Assange. So I think she and the whole American political establishment, which Hillary Clinton represents, have a bitterness against Assange. And it really is a classic case where the people who commit the crimes are scot-free and respected citizens, and those who reveal the crimes are persecuted. That is the essential perversion of the Assange case. I completely agree with you on its importance. You know, there's an old principle in penology that says you go to prison as punishment. You don't go to prison for punishment. In other words, going to prison is the punishment. You're not supposed to be punished when you're in jail more. Taking away your freedom, that is the punishment. Well, the Assange case is just the opposite of that. They have been torturing this guy. There's no other word for it. They have tried to destroy him, and they may be very close to doing that. Now they want to try to bring him here and put him in one of the world's most highest security and harshest prisons. He's already been in horrific state for years. So I think every day that he's suffering in some prison cell somewhere makes Hillary Clinton and some of the people around her feel good. So that's where I think a lot of this is coming from. There's certainly institutional anger at Assange for revealing secrets. But I think it's more in the political establishment that you get this intensity. The people that would come down on Biden if he ever tried to make some kind of a deal to free Assange. They're coming from American political elected and sort of corporate officials like Hillary Clinton, not so much from those anonymous people inside the security apparatus.
All right. That's a good analysis. The thing, he wasn't charged with revealing Hillary Clinton's misdeeds in 2016 and what she did in Honduras back in 2009. But he's being charged under the Espionage Act, which was, we know that was written to quell dissent in this country against the quell dissent against World War One entry. Eugene Debs and Victor Berger and others were put in jail. But this is all about revealing through the war logs and the collateral murder. From 2010, I mean, this is 11 years ago, and that's what he is being charged with. What do you make of the perversion of the Espionage Act to go after him?
Well, first of all, the charges are just cooked up. The idea was, we got to find some way to destroy this person. So find me some violations that you can name. That was the idea. The specific charges are of secondary importance, I think, to those who want to persecute Assange. But you're absolutely right about the Espionage Act. Now, World War One probably was the period when there was the fiercest repression in the United States of dissenting view. If you were against the draft or resisting the draft, or if you were against the war, or even like Eugene Debs, you just got up and made a speech saying, war is mainly beneficial for capitalists. And he didn't even mention that particular war. It was just a general speech in jail. We had the Palmer raids, the expulsion of thousands of people from the United States. And so this is considered a shameful episode in American history. Therefore, it's remarkable to see that the prosecutors have had to go back to this odious law and use it as a basis for persecuting Assange. But we all know that the courts in America on cases like this are very politically influenced. And maybe the nature of the specific charges against Assange isn't as important as the generalized understanding in the heart of the American political elite that Assange did something terrible and he has to be punished.
Right. What are the implications, the long-term consequences for journalism if Julian Assange is finally extradited here, if he doesn't die first, and sent off to that prison in Colorado? What are the implications for people like yourself who write columns that are very heavy?
It's a scary episode. On the other hand, I don't think it marks a real turnaround. I mean, we have been seeing intensifying pressure on dissenting views. Boy, you've definitely seen it during the Ukraine war. People who have any doubt about the official narrative on Ukraine suddenly can't be on Twitter. They can't be on Facebook. I heard a story on the radio today about how difficult it is in Russia to criticize the Russian position. And I thought, wow, it sounds a lot like the United States. I mean, here we have an absolute taboo on anything that is other than 100% cheerleading for the Ukraine government. So I don't think the Assange case is an extreme example because of what they've done to him. But actually, the threats to freedom of the press and freedom of speech in the United States precede and I'm sure will outlive Assange.
You know, that's the reason why I didn't play any Shostakovich today. I didn't want to be named as a an accessory. I didn't play as an accessory to Russia. I mean, it really is. I haven't watched anything on MSNBC or CNN since the first week of the Ukrainian conflict because you only get one side. And if anybody questions it, we can do it here. But are people just self-censoring or do they actually believe people like Wolf Blitzer and the gang at CNN and MSNBC and even Fox that all you hear is about Russian atrocities and Ukrainian victories?
Those outlets are effectively quasi-government. I mean, it didn't take a week before the spokesman for the president, spokeswoman for the president of the United States, turned up as a commentator on MSNBC. Look at all the generals, the retired generals and former CIA officers and others who have turned up as eminent commentators on CNN. They are part of the narrative. This is not journalism. It's just stenography. There's a sound box that reverberates out of Washington. All of those networks line up to sing from the same choir book. And don't forget that, you know, the Washington elite is a very closed circle, and everybody in Washington wants to be part of that. And if you start questioning official narratives, you never have lunch in that town again. You don't get an interview. You don't get invited to the Hamptons and to those nice parties. So there's a tremendous pull in Washington not to become what John McCain called a wacko bird, which is anybody who questions the official narrative on American foreign policy.
Well, you can. I'll tell you where, if you want to read some great columns about the situation in Ukraine, you go look at Stephen Kinzer's columns in the Boston Globe. They're tremendous. You can get them online. Go to his Twitter feed, StephenKinzer.com, at Stephen Kinzer. Do you have a website, Steve?
I do. All of my columns are on StephenKinzer.com, so you can. The ones you can't get through the paywall at the Globe, you can find them on the...
Right. That's what I did. You know, I didn't want to pay that dollar a month. But no, $10, whatever. I would, but I was able to read them on your website. Stephen Kinzer, I really wanted to talk a lot about Ukraine, but we're out of time here. And in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I think this conflict's going on for a long time. We'd love to have you back and just spend a whole hour talking about that. Steve is also... he is a, what do you call it? You are a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. So he's there. He's a busy guy. And I'm going to go out here. This is Hesitation Blues, a 30-second backdrop on it. Steve. That's just a pastiche of Hesitation Blues, Steve. I know you know that tune.
Yeah, and in fact, it reminds me of that general we just had on talking about Latin America. Because what she's saying about the resources of Latin America that she covets is, can we get them now or do we have to hesitate?
All right. You got the last word. Stephen Kinzer, thank you very much, and we'll be talking to you soon.
I hope so. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot. What a great interview that was. Now, see, Reggie, that was a good interview, wasn't it? Did you get some information out of that?
No, I mean, it was a really good interview. I mean, it's where else are you going to hear that level of content only here at a station that is solely supported by listeners, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And if the listening audience appreciate the content that you just finished hearing during this past hour, you can show your financial support right now by calling 212-209-2950. And what is it for a pledge of $75?
Yeah, $75. The Assange Reader.
Right.
You get both those books. Now, listen, Reggie, Assange is gravely ill. All right. Maybe this show is going to come to an end and the last show is going to be an obituary for Julian Assange. All right. Maybe that's going to be it. We'd like to continue and do this kind of work. And we need your support. Make a contribution of $75. Get these books on Julian Assange. His situation is that bad, Reggie.
Well, I'm hoping for the best for Julian Assange, no doubt. I think no one, and the powers that be who is trying to do everything in their power to just shut this man down and because of what he represents, I don't think they themselves are ready if something like that happens. I really don't think that something like that won't be ignored by the populace. I think that there will be such an outrage. Now, yes, there's going to be a lot of hemming and hawing about this, and God forbid if he pass away in prison, it wouldn't surprise me one bit that there's going to be a little bit of a backstep. They will be saying the powers that be, the press secretary will say something like, well, we didn't do any, we did not intend any harm to Assange. We wanted to put him in the front of a court of justice so he will get his due or something like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, you know, look, it's a guy that's been stuck in a mine shaft. You remember those guys in Chile that were stuck in a mine shaft, all right, for, I don't know, 30, imagine being by yourself there for 3 years. But he hadn't seen any sunlight. The only thing that's different is he hears a lot of noise from a lot of people, as it is in most prisons, but it's very intense there because there's thousands of prisoners there. And so he's got to go through that, and he hasn't committed a crime.
And also, what I find really disgusting is about the nerve of mainstream media. And I shouldn't be surprised, but still, it's still disgusting on how they can tout the narrative about being a vanguard of free speech and information and making sure that journalists or the fourth estate is highly regarded, where things like this happens, and not just with Assange as well. It's also with people like with Mumia Abu-Jamal, with the assassination of the reporter from Al Jazeera, who was only reporting the conditions of the situation with the Palestinians over in the Gaza area. It's really, but here at WBAI, We'll do our best to give you a content that is different and constructive from our counterparts over at the corporate media and even public radio, public media as well, too. So 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your support to this radio station. If you appreciate what Randy does here on a weekly basis and his efforts, you should show your support.
They could become a buddy,
station.
Right?
Yes, you can.
How
absolutely
do you do that, Reggie?
Simple as calling the radio, the pledge line. Tell them, give the pledge line again, 212-209-2950. Tell them that you want to become a sustaining member, because that's what a BAI buddy is, as little as $10 a month. You can, it'll come out of your bank account. It will come out of your credit card, debit card, whatever. You just have to talk to that person. And that would be the perfect way for WBAI to see a guarantee sustenance.
Money. That's it. Right.
Money.
Cash. Moolah.
Yeah.
Dinero.
Where that would be the best idea, where we get thousands of people donating to this radio station, tens of thousands of people donating to this radio station, and we can guarantee that X amount, and that would, in a perfect world, will lessen the on-air pitches that we usually do here at WBAI.
Yeah. You know, you just that Assange reader. It's a great book. Two great books. I got one in front of me right now. It's Trial of Julian Assange.
I was thumbing through that, and I was like, wow, Niels is dropping a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And not only that, he's been here at WBI. Mm-hmm. And you get the book by Tariq Ali and Margaret Ratner Kunstler called In Defense of Assange. You get those two books for $75 donation. Now, if you already have it, I know some of my friends out there do, why not get it again and give it to somebody else as a gift? We need to get the information out there, folks. We got to do everything we can to save everything we possibly can. And that is also to keep this station, which has been so generous, you know, taking a lot of heat for me doing this show over the last 6 years here at WBAI, Assange County.